Today, I would like to discuss with you an individual who we don't hear too much about. You'll find an introduction to him in 1 Kings 19 and verse 19. 1 Kings 19, verse 19. We find that the individual who is going to meet this person is called Elijah, and he has been told to anoint this individual to take his stead. In fact, who we're talking about here is called Elisha. So let's look, first of all, at this introduction in verse 19. So Elijah departed from there and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was ploughing with 12 yoke of oxen before him, and he was with the 12th. And Elijah passed by him and threw his mantle on him. And he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and says, "Please let me kiss my father and my mother, and then I will follow you." And he said to him, "Go back again, for what have I done to you?" So Elisha turned back from him, took a yoke of oxen, slaughtered them, boiled their flesh, used the oxen's equipment and gave it to the people, and they ate. And he arose, followed Elijah, and became his servant. This individual comes directly after Elijah. And there are many, many aspects in his life that point to us about another who has to come after Elijah, even Jesus Christ. So let's look at some of these things and learn some of the things from this first prophet. We find that he, when he was called here, showed a particular type of character. We wonder, do we ever show this similar character? Because we should. Look at what, let's break it down, let's re-examine what we've just read so that we get this exact. So he departed from there. Elijah had been sent, he went, he had found Elisha. Now, Elisha was a man who was well off. How do we know this? Well, he was in a field with 12 yokes of oxen. He had servants ploughing. He himself was coming up behind them, which was common for the day for the owner of the property. You see, you should see everybody in front of you and what they were doing, so you would go last. That was one of the things. So this is telling us who Elisha was. The second thing that we know about him is that he killed the oxen. If he only had been working for another man, he could never have done this. They had to belong to himself. This is one of the things we have to understand. This is a man who was coming from wealth. This was a man who was coming from a position of authority. And yet, as he was ploughing, and as anyone who has come from a farming background may be aware, when you plough, the first thing that you do is you set your eye directly in front of you as to where you're going. And then you keep your eye there and you keep the plough as steady as you can to do that. So he would have been concentrating completely and totally on the job in hand. He was into his work. He was ploughing a field. He was aware of all the ploughers in front of them and could see they were doing what they were supposed to be doing. This man was doing his job. That was it. Simple. Until a stranger walked up behind him. A stranger threw a lump of coat, a mantle, an outer garment over his shoulders and just walked on. He didn't speak. He didn't make any declaration. He just walked on past him. But for Elisha, he understood the meaning. He knew what a mantle was. He knew that this was the opportunity to change, as it were, professions. He had been asked, in a not an uncertain way, to take a new course. Look what he did. He immediately shouted to Elijah. To do that, he had to stop ploughing. He had to forget his goal up there. He had to put all that to one side. He shouted to Elijah and he said to him, "Let me first go and kiss my father and mother." He wanted to say goodbye. He knew what was being asked of him. He was not arguing with the fact of what was being asked of him. He merely stated or requested permission to make his goodbyes. Elijah allowed it. Of course, did it. No problem. Then Elisha did something that we have to really take into consideration. He took that which was to make his ability as a farmer work. He took his own oxen and slaughtered them. He shared the meat with all the rest of the people that were there. He shared the meat with his parents. He shared the meat with everybody in that area, in that field, all them other workers. He shared it with them all. That meal was him saying goodbye. He took the plow that was the means to cut the land for doing that work that he had previously been called to do, shall we say, and he burnt it. He used it as the means to be able to make this final peace offerings with them. Now, having attended to all of that, having completed everything, having wiped away all his past life so that he no longer had anything to do with them and could never go back to it, he set his eye on a new target. And he became the servant of Elisha the prophet. This is a man of great virtue. A man who knew that when he had something to do, you had to do it with all your heart, with everything that's in you, completely and totally. This was a man who foreran Jesus Christ. And so we need to look and see what he did, how he did it, how he approached life. Because this was not God in the flesh, this was a man. But he came after Elijah the prophet. If we move now a little further, we find that Elisha has been the servant of Elijah for some time, because Elijah had a number of things to do before his departure. And as the day for Elijah to depart came, we find that what had been established was almost like a school of the prophets. There was other prophets now. We remember that not so long ago, in this particular story scenario, Elijah had complained that he was the only one. There was no one else. But God had highlighted that wasn't true, that there was others. And Elisha was one of these others. So now there has been an establishment of a school. Those who would obey God, who could be taught to teach and guide others as they went round the country. And Elijah had established that. And Elisha was going to take it over. But because these were a school of prophets, they knew, and they kept telling Elijah, your master is going to be taken away from you. And Elijah's reply was very simple. I know. I know my master's been taken away. So Elijah says to him, when I'm going here, I have to go on somewhere else. You stay behind. You look after the school. You sort the things out here. But he said, no. I'm going with you. As long as you're alive, as long as you're here, as long as you're in this area, I'm sticking to you like glue. I'm not moving. I'm following you no matter where you go. This was the role of a servant. And he would remain a servant until the very end, because that was his job. That was what he was called to do out in that plough field, to be a servant initially, to serve. They got to a river. Elijah put forth his mantle, touched the water parted, and Elisha and Elijah walked over. And as they were about to walk over, Elijah again said to Elisha, you stay on this side. I'll go on a wee bit ahead. No, still sticking with you, not leaving. So Elijah says to him, okay, you know I'm going away. So what do you want? What do you want me to give to you before I go? What are you after? I want us to look now at what Elisha asked for. You'll find it in 2 Kings chapter 2, verse 9. It's halfway down the verse. Please let a double portion of your spirit be upon me. This was a very unusual thing to ask. Very unusual. Because what Elisha was asking was, he was recognizing that his master's authority was great with God. He was recognizing that for him to come after this individual, he literally had to outshine him. He literally had to be better than him. But he knew that that wasn't physically within him. So he asked him for permission, not just for a portion of the Spirit with the mantle to be passed to him, which was normal. Two portions. In other words, I want to be able to do more than you've done. I want to be able to do better than you've done. That's what it would have, in many ways, have come across to Elijah. And we need to understand, Elijah didn't know how to respond to this. He says, look, what you've asked is not mine to give you. I can't do that. But if you see how I'm taken away, then you will know that God has given it to you. You've got the two portions. You will be better than me. You will go out and do great things. You will walk ahead. And as we know, Elijah was taken up into the heavens in a fiery chariot, and Elisha witnessed the whole thing perfectly. So here he was, standing alone. He tore his clothes because he was vexed at losing Elijah and knew he would never see him again. It was a complicated situation. You see, he was no longer a servant. His master was gone. He now had to walk out and take the full responsibility that had previously been his master's responsibility. He was to walk out and, in the spirit of Elijah, rule the prophet's school and teach all about God. He was to address kings. He was to talk to people. He was to make decisions. He was to go to war where required. So here was a man now ready for a change. He had been prepared. He knew he could do it because he had witnessed what had happened. So as he lifted the mantle, he walked back to a river. The river was flowing. Here was the first opportunity for him to see the faith, the double portion at work. He had witnessed it. He knew it was there. He had been given confirmation. So he took the mantle. You'll read it in verse 14 of chapter 2 of 2 Kings. Chapter 2, 2 Kings. He took the mantle of Elijah, which had fallen from him, and he struck the water and said, "Where is the Lord God of Elijah?" And then he also had struck the water. It divided its way, this way and that, and Elisha crossed over. When he met the prophets, we're told in the next verse, they recognized immediately the change in him. They recognized that the spirit of Elijah was in him, that he had the full authority of Elijah, that he could speak on behalf of God to the people of Israel and to the people of Judah. We have to understand that Elisha represents those who come after Elijah. And initially, we recognize that to be Jesus. But Jesus Christ walked with us in power and authority for 3.5 years. But the spirit and authority and power of Jesus Christ has been walking this earth for 2,000 years. How? In you. Each single one of you are Elisha. Each single one of you are the Spirit of Christ, and you will do greater things that are expected of you. So let's look at a little more about Elisha's life. Let's take it a little further. It wasn't long before Elisha, while he was with the prophets, that they had come across a little problem. The people of the area and the city had said to Elisha, "Look, this is a lovely place to live. See, it's very nice. You can see that it's great, but we have one wee problem with it. And the problem's this: the water's bad. The land won't grow anything. But we quite like being where we are. It's just, you know, the water's bad." Now, you and I would have thought to ourselves, well, you know, if the water's bad and nothing's growing, it doesn't matter how nice the scenery is, you'd move, wouldn't we? That's not how we would think about things, but these prophets had that opportunity. So they brought it to Elisha. And they said to Elisha, "What can we do about it? How can we solve this?" So Elisha says to them, "That's no bother. Just give me a new bowl, put a little salt in it." So they brought it to him. You'll find this story, 2 Kings 2:19. And then in verse 21, we read, "And he went to the source of the water. He cast in the salt and said, 'Thus saith the Lord, I have healed this water, and there will be no more death nor barrenness in it.'" Why highlight this? We're a church that's aware of sickness and disease. We're aware that the world is plagued with problems and difficulties. And we have been told time and time again through the New Testament and the Old Testament that the source of all those problems, the source of all those difficulties, is Satan. And just like Elisha, we have been sent to address the source. Not the well. Not the stream that's running from the well. The source. When we speak healing, instruction, encouragement, we affect directly the source that that literally attacks this world, that influences it. We're attacking Satan with every word that we speak, with every prayer that we make, with every scripture that we quote. We strike a blow right at the heart of Satan and into his kingdom. With every decision we make to meet together, to praise God, to have a Bible study, to pray for the sick, whatever it is, every time we do that, we are striking a blow against Satan. We are hitting the source of the problem. Now, it's like a war. We're not exactly making ourselves well liked with them. But we have to recognize that it's always the source that we're hitting, not the people. The ones that come against us, the people that argue with us, the people that fall out with us, even the diseases themselves that we come across from time to time, and the problems and the difficulties that can attack our lives. These are not the problem. It's always Satan. He is the problem. He is the instigator. He is the one who wants to cause us bother. So we have to address the source. And Elisha recognized here that while this was a pleasant place to live, and let's face it, the earth is a pleasant place to live, isn't it? We quite like being here. We quite enjoy being able to live our lives in this beautiful place. But we're aware that the poison is here. So just like these prophets who couldn't move away, we've been sent to the source to sort it out. In another place, we read that Elisha was going up from a place and he was attacked verbally by a group of youngsters, that says youths came to him. This wasn't four or five. We're told that at least 42 of them were there. At least. So how did the prophet deal with that? This attack against him, against his person. Because as you go through the scriptures, you find this particular incident is very unusual. It's not one we normally come across. You'll find it in verse 23 of 2 Kings, chapter 2. And at the end of it, we find that what they were saying to him was, "Go up, you baldy head. Go up, you baldy head." In other words, they were saying, "Hey, baldy, get out of here." That sort of thing. That was the sort of attitude. The prophet, in verse 24, cursed them in God's name. Immediately, two female bears came out of the woods and mauled 42 of the youths. That's something we said, well, that doesn't sound right. Why would you do that? Because of the disrespect of who he was. Because he knew who he was. Do we? Are we aware that you are the temple of Jesus Christ? That you are the temple of the Holy Spirit? That you are Christ in flesh? Therefore, when somebody criticizes you, when somebody pulls you down, when somebody calls you names, when somebody attacks you, do you think God wants that? He wants you to have an understanding and a respect for the office he has given you. He wants you to know who you are and to stand firm. So that if someone attacks you or belittles you or makes fun of you, you can talk directly to God and ask him to intervene. And just like Elisha, God will. He will take action. He will highlight the fact that you are his property, his people. He will look after you. And it has happened. And it does happen. If we wanted to go to a New Testament aspect of this, we are simply reminded that Jesus himself was walking one day when he saw a tree which he thought should have been given fruit. When he went to the tree, there was nothing there. No preparation for him. So he cursed it. And the tree immediately died. So you see, it's not as unusual what happened here as we first think. It happened also with Jesus. He also spoke when the things weren't just the way it was meant to be, when it wasn't meeting what was required. As we go through, we find that Elisha's fame started to grow among all the nations, and the kings would start talking about what they should do and what they shouldn't do. And three kings had decided to go to war because another king had decided not to pay them the monies due to them. So these kings were the king of Moab. It was the king of Edom, the king of Judah, and the king of Israel. And it was the king of Judah that said, "Is there not a prophet that we could check on this?" You'll find this in 2 Kings 3, verse 11. And one of the servants of the king of Israel answered and said, "Elisha the son of Saphath is here, who poured water on the hands of Elijah." And so they went to him. And in verse 14 we read, "And Elisha said, 'As the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand, surely were it not that I regard the present of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, I would not look you or see you.'" Do you get the feeling there was a problem? There was a problem. The king of Israel did not obey God. The king of Judah did. And it's interesting. Here we have a situation where a prophet is being asked to intervene in a matter of national importance. And the prophet's reply to them was very simple. "If it were not that one who honored God was among you, I wouldn't give you the time of day." Is that how we think from time to time? Because it should be. We're not to have any aspect at all with sin. And therefore the workers of sin, the ones who do evil, the ones who continually follow after their own lust, their own things, we are to actively separate ourselves from. We're not to engage with them or socialize with them or to be part of them. But when we see those who are seeking to obey God, when we see those who want to do what is right, even if it's not how we would expect it to be, but we recognize the hallmark of Christ in them, then we interact with them. We need to. We have to. Because that's expected of us. There's no expectation on us to become part of the world. We're separated from the world. We're separated so that we become a different people. We have been set aside for a specific purpose, to carry the fullness of Christ. And because we carry the fullness of Christ, we are made holy. And as the Bible reminds us, what has holiness to do with unholiness? We live in an unholy world. We live in it, but we're not part of it. Because God chose to allow our light be a witness to them. But we have to understand that we need to keep ourselves separate. Now, when I say that, keep ourselves separate, I don't mean that we separate ourselves from the people of the world. We need to separate ourselves from the systems of the world. Do you know how many Christians I meet who talk about, oh, if I could win the lottery? Seriously. Why would they even want to put their name forward for it? Why would they even want to buy a ticket? That's the world. It's part of the system. If you were to win, you've taken a hand out from Satan. A backhander. And we all know how that works. There'd be expectations on you. We're commanded, remember the Lord's Prayer, to come before God for our provision on a day-to-day basis. We're literally to literally be needing God to intervene on our behalf daily. The world looks to establish itself for the future. It needs to be sure that it has got a nice little safety net round itself, just in case of hard times. But we're not meant to be using that safety net. We're meant to be living in the presence, nature of God. Now, I know that's very hard. I know that's very difficult. But yet, that's why we're supposed to be developing in faith. You can only please God with faith. And you can only have faith when you need God. You don't have faith when you don't need God. You don't have faith when you don't have problems. You don't have faith at any other times. You only have faith when it comes, when push comes to shove, to use an old colloquialism. We need constantly to be dependent on God. And this is one of the things that we have to understand. We shouldn't get involved in the world. We should keep ourselves separate from it. But it's very difficult to do. And if we go to 2 Kings 4, verse 1, we find that here's one of the problems that we concern ourselves about. A certain woman who was the wife of the sons of the prophet cried out to Elisha saying, "Your servant, my husband, is dead. And you know that your servant feared the Lord, but creditors are coming to take my two sons to be his slave." So Elisha said to her, "What do you want me to do about it? What do you want me to do?" Before she answers him, he tells her what she's going to do. "Tell me what you have in your house." So she said to him, "I've got a small jar of oil." "That'll do. Go out and borrow from all your neighbors. Empty jars. Any form of container you can get your hands on. Just go and get them." So she did. Her and her sons went out around all the area, and anyone who had an empty jar, an empty pot, an empty wine skin, anything that could hold liquid, she got. And then he said to her, then go in, shut your door, you and your sons, and fill them all up. And she began, one wee jar of oil, until every single one of those pots and containers were full, without an exception. Every one filled to the brim. And she was still filling, and the last one was coming up to the full, and she says, give me another pot quickly. There's loads in this thing. Sorry, don't have any more. Instantly, it stops. All finished. All done. So she went and she told the prophet, yep, I got loads of oil. So he says, go sell olive oil, pay off the debts, and live on the rest. Here we had someone who didn't have a pension or a bank balance or a plan to deal with the credit crunch. They had ran into a severe problem. They had incurred debts during the life of their husband, and then their husband was taken away, and as a result of that, they now were in dire straits. But they had God. And they had a prophet who knew the answer to the question. God provides. He simply told her how. But you know, we don't believe that. Oh, yes, you believe it's wrote in the Bible. Yes, we believe that it happened to this lady. Yes, it might even happen to other people. But it doesn't happen to us. We have to prepare for eventualities. But every time you do that, you're stepping into the world. And you're stepping away from your dependence on God. We have to be as little children. Little children and a family, 3-4 years old, run about having a good time. When they get hungry, they come in and say, feed me. They don't care how you're going to feed them. They're not worried about how much food costs or anything else. They're only concerned about one thing, feed me. And guess what? You do. And they're fed, and they go back and do what they need to do. No other concerns. And that's how our attitude should be as well. We have a God who feeds us. We have a God who meets our needs. We have a God who supplies our shortcomings. We would like a God who would give us loads of money and let us decide how to spend it. But he's wiser than us. So he just gives us what we need. And this is something that we frequently have problems with. But it's something that we shouldn't. It's God who supplies the need. Only God. Satan steals and destroys. God supplies, meets your need, helps you. Moving on. What else can we learn from the story of Elisha? The prophet regularly made road trips from one place to another. And on his way, he passed a particular home of a lady who recognized that this was a man of God and wanted, you know, to help. She didn't have a lot. At least we don't think she had a lot. But what she had, she was willing to share with him. So she would invite him in and make him a meal and let him rest. Then she discussed with her husband. She says, you know, this individual, he comes past every regular basis. He's coming past all the time. Wouldn't it be nice if we were to set aside a wee room solely for him? It was a lovely, generous act that this woman was doing. She had seen a need, and she wanted to fill it. And when the prophet realized what she had done, and he was touched. And he wanted to repair. Because she'd never asked him for anything. She never expected anything. But he wanted to give her something. He wanted to give her a gift from God. So he chatted, and there was really nothing she needed. But then his servant pointed out to him, well, you know, husband's very old, but she doesn't actually have a child. No child. So the prophet speaks. And he says very directly and very forcefully, this time next year you're going to have a son. And the woman's horrified. She's always wanted her own child. It's her dearest heart's desire. But she has difficulty accepting it. Please don't lie to me, she says. Don't deceive me. It's not fair. It would be cruel of you to do that. But he said, no, I'm not lying to you. I'm not deceiving you. This time next year, you will have a son. And his words come through. She does have a son. He tells her what's going to happen, and it happens. God works like that with us. He tells us what's going to happen, and it will happen. It always passes exactly as God says it will pass. It occurs. But we have an enemy called Satan. And that enemy murders, steals, kills, destroys, breaks things up, causes problems, generally upset and anger. Anything he can do. And his main goal is to stop us trusting God. And here we have a very important aspect of what to do when those things come into your life. When this woman's son had grew slightly, he was still a young lad, we don't know what age exactly, he was out in the fields with his fathers. Suddenly he developed a very bad headache, cried out to his father, who told him to be carried to his mother, and she nursed him on her knee until noon, and then he died. He died. This present from God, this gift that had been given, this thank you from the prophet, died. The woman took the child, put him up in the prophet's room. She then asked her husband for leave to go and visit the prophet. He said, why? Didn't know the child was dead. Oh, no reason. Just have to do it. It's not a new moon. It's not a Sabbath. Why would you want to go? Oh, just need to go. Didn't tell him. Everything's all right. Headed off, she met the servant of the prophet who had been sent to meet her. He asked her, is there anything wrong? No, everything's fine. Everything's perfect. Hunky-dory. Lovely. No problems at all. Moved on. Got to the prophet. Asked him the question. Why did you lie to me? Why did you tell me that my son would be given to me and now he has been taken from me? Why did you do this? And the prophet, totally unable to know what's happened. God didn't tell me this. God didn't make this known to me. So he says immediately to his servant, take my staff, go. Lay my staff on the child and go. But she won't leave him. She says to him, you have to come. And he does. And as he's on his way, the servant comes back and he says, I left your staff over the child, as you said, but nothing. No difference. So he went in. And here was the problem. Here was the problem. Here's how Elisha saw the problem. God hadn't told him that this child was temporary. Therefore, as far as Elisha was concerned, this child was to live. The fact that the child was dead might have been an inconvenience, but it wasn't God's will. Therefore, the only thing that could be done was rebuke the enemy. And Elisha did. And you know what happened? Nothing. He lay on top of the child and nothing happened. Now he could have given up and said, oh well, guess that's it. We'll give up now. We've tried. We've put the staff. I've come personally. I've anointed him. I've lay on top of him. I've breathed. I've prayed. I've done everything I need to do. But instead of that, he simply walked around the room and he reminded God. He says, look, this is a non-acceptable outcome. The only outcome that will work here is for this child to be restored to life. And so he went back to it. And that's what we need to understand. When this child sneezed 7 times and came back to life and was restored to his mother, we never hear much more about him except when it's told to a king. But he wouldn't have been brought back had the prophet not refused to accept that Satan had done. In other words, Elisha knew God's will in this matter. And no matter what evidence was presented to him to the contrary, he was not willing to accept it. It was not acceptable. There's a lot about Elisha. I have a lot more highlighted. But time is challenging me. I do want to finish though with one last thing, just to remind you that this is someone who reflects Jesus Christ. You'll find it in 2 Kings 4, verse 22. A man from Baal had come and brought the man of God bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley bread, freshly ripe grain in his knapsack, and he says, give it to the people to eat. His servant looks at them, said, there's over 100 people here. How are we going to feed them with this little amount? I mean, it's not feasible. We can't take this small amount of food and feed 100 people. Or to which Elisha says, give it to the people, that they may eat, for the Lord says they shall eat and there shall be food left over. And there was. Do you know, in the Gospels we come across another 2 versions of this particular miracle, where we're shown how God provides from what we have. We've seen it a couple of times throughout the life of Elisha. We see it continually in the life of Jesus. And as we go through the Gospels and into the letters of the epistles and all the rest, we know that God provides from the resources at hand. He makes it work. So yes, we're a small church here at the moment. But out of this small church, God can reach whoever he wants. He can make the difference that he wants to make. He can give us whatever is needed. We become the oil poured. We become the bread to feed the hungry. It doesn't matter how big we are, only that we trust God. For he is our provision.